You're listening to Intellectual Erection,
a place where we talk about the naughty.
To stimulate your thinking.
You're listening
to
Intellectual Erection.
Intellectual Erection.
Передачу, где мы говорим о диспутам субъекта секса.
Мы говорим о любви.
To stimulate your thinking.
Welcome back to another episode of Intellectual Erection. I'm your host, Patrick, and today I'm speaking with sexologist Marla Renee Stewart.
And I slapped her, and I ended up slapping the nose ring out of her nose.
We cover a lot in this episode because Marla does a lot in the sex positive communities. She writes books and chapters and does podcasts and shows up on TV and does therapy and runs workshops and lectures at universities and is a general sexologist and sex educator, runs a conference called Sex Down South and has her own company called Velvet Lips on sex education. So there's a lot in here. We talk about race and kink, some of the people that she works with, and her future conferences coming up. And we also get into how her work has been impacted by COVID and the Black Lives Matter resurgence. So listen up. There's so much good content here. Another reminder that I am continuing to offer my podcast, my platform, to BIPOC voices for amplification. So if you are interested, please email me at intellectualerection@gmail.com and we can arrange to have an interview or something that you've pre-recorded, broadcasted on this platform. Or if you've recorded a podcast yourself, I can also rebroadcast it on my platform to help amplify that. And as always, listen, subscribe, review, and most of all, enjoy. I'm sitting here today with...
Hey, it's me, Marla Renee Stewart. I'm happy to be here.
Hi, Marla. It's great to see you. Before we get started, actually, I wanted to read your bio for the listeners because I thought it was great. It's a concise bio, but you've done so much work that I want to kind of have the listeners know where you've worked and what you've done so that when you talk about some of this stuff, they have a reference point. And I'm sure maybe you forgot some of the things that you've done.
There's a lot.
Yeah. So it says here, Marla Renee Stewart, MA, as in a master's, is a professional sexologist, intimacy, relationship, sex coach, speaker, and author. She's the owner of Velvet Lips, a sexuality education company, as well as Contract Liberation, a company focused on research for nonprofit groups. As a lecturer at Clayton State University, she teaches sociology and women's and gender studies. As the co-founder of the Sex Down South Conference, Marla aims to bring diverse groups together to learn and share their experiences in the essence of being authentic and fostering sexual liberation across communities. Marla has studied human sexuality for over 19 years, has educated over 20,000 people in over 13 years, given over 400 workshops, and has served over 100 clients in her private practice all around the world. She has had her influence in the media as well. She has written over 200 articles, featured in 20 magazines and books, and she has been on over 50 podcasts and independent television shows. She was featured on Netflix's Trigger Warning with Killer Mike and VH1's Love and Hip Hop Atlanta. In addition, she also sits on the board for Spark Reproductive Justice Now and is on the Community Advisory Board of the Diverse Sexualities and Research Education Institute. She co-wrote her first book, The Ultimate Guide to Seduction and Foreplay, in 2020 with Dr. Jessica O'Reilly, and she's currently writing a chapter and co-editing An Intersectional Approach to Sex Therapy, coming out in 2021. Wow. Okay, that is mouthful. There's some very exciting things in there, and I want to touch a little bit on all of them. I want to say I'm very excited to hear that you were on Trigger Warning with Killer Mike. I've watched that whole series at least 3 times, if not 4, all the way through.
Yes.
And I'm trying to remember if I got this right. Were you in the episode, because I haven't seen it in a while, were you in the episode where Mike is trying to make porn ethical porn around learning skills?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yes. Learning how to do, common skills that we can do, or like, you know, handyman type skills or handy person type skills, along with making it into porn form, because that's what people who are generally unemployed tend to watch a lot of. So, yes. So
that was great. I love that. I love that whole show. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, it was really amazing. It was really funny. It was great.
So before we dive into all this stuff, the first thing I usually do on this show is I ask an origin question. And it's a two-parter. The first part is a little bit almost psychoanalytical, because I like to ask if you remember the first time that you encountered sex or sexuality in your early childhood and what that was like. Because I'm always curious what it's like when we first emerge into the world of sexuality. And I've had a whole lot of interesting responses. I also put the caveat that you don't have to answer that question if you don't want to, but it's out there. And then the second part of it is kind of how you got into the sex positive communities.
Yeah, so there's a lot there. So the first part of your question, thinking about my experience as a child and my first sexual experiences as a child, I would have to say had to be when I was about four, I believe maybe three or four. And my mom had this boyfriend, and we went over to the boyfriend's house, and they put me in his room to take a nap, and I was not sleepy. And so I was just like roaming around the room, and I found some Playboy magazines of his. And I was just sort of like fascinated, and I just took off all my clothes. First of all, I was a naked child, so I really loved to be naked all the time. My mom did not like, was just like, why does my child like to be naked all the time? But I just like to be naked all the time. And so I took off all my clothes and basically started emulating these poses that were in the Playboy. And I would say that's sort of my first experience around, I guess, sexuality, not necessarily around sex per se, but that was like my first sexuality and experience. And then I can recall when I was maybe in second grade, I had a friend where we used to masturbate together. So she had like these two twin beds, you know, and we just each be in the bed. We were each in our own bed masturbating with like stuffed toy animals or something like that. So I remember that. So that would say that was like my first sexual experience as a child. So with a playmate or a person who is also doing the same thing. So
I've heard actually a few stories about some of my guests who have humped stuffed animals and things like that. I have heard stories about people discovering the Playboy magazines. That's a common one actually, but not emulating the poses. So that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
At that time when you were doing this, when you first discovered those magazines, did it feel just natural or did it feel at all inappropriate or taboo?
No, it never felt inappropriate or taboo. I mean, I was supposed to be sleeping, right? Yeah. But so that was the only thing that was like out of place because I wasn't sleeping. But my mom was actually very sex, what we would probably deem as sex positive now, just because she was very much started educating me, I think around second grade, around my body and sort of sexuality in general, like age appropriate stuff. Just because she did not want me to be a teenage mother like she was. So she was very much very focused on making sure that I took a lot of sexual responsibility for myself and knew my body and knew what my body was capable of. So I'm really extremely grateful and appreciative that my mother took that route.
Wow. So, it sounds like you got lucky with a good sex ed at home.
Oh yeah.
And the second part then is, how did you get involved in the sex positive communities? And this is a term that I use as a sort of umbrella term to cover things like kink, polyamory, BDSM, what else, sex work, and everything to do with everything else, sex education.
All the things that encompass all the things that I do.
Yeah, yeah.
So this work really originated, I believe, in college. So my friends used to, I was studying human sexuality at the time, and I think I was just always had a natural inclination towards human sexuality. And my friends were not having orgasms. And they would come to me because I was having great orgasms and dating lots of people. And you know, being in San Francisco at that time, I was very familiar with, you know, polyamorous and non-monogamous communities, as well as kinky folks. And my friends, you know, they would come to me for advice. And so I just became that person to always give them sexual advice. And then so for me, this job and what I do is really came from an organic place of, and I mean, when I say organic, people who don't even know me, who I could pass by on the street, could talk to me about their sex lives for whatever reason. Don't even know what I do. But so many strangers have come up to me just talk to me about their sex life. And I'm just like, I'm fascinated all the time. Like, how,
wow,
like, are they so comfortable to talk about sex, which is such a taboo subject, with a stranger whom they know nothing about? So, I find it really, really fascinating on for that aspect. But yeah, this has been very, very organic for me. Everything has just sort of fell into place. And similar to, you know, my business in Sex Down South, things have fallen into place. And I'm very, I feel very lucky and proud.
I've heard a lot of good things about Sex Down South. And what was the other thing? Oh, yes. You mentioned you were in San Francisco, which I know has a long history of sort of polyamorous ethics and knowledge around it. It's one of the hubs. I think I have in my Google Drive a 30-page document on consent out of San Francisco.
Yeah. And, you know, as people, you know, lots of people could argue, are we monogamous people? Are we non-monogamous people? It is what it is. Like, really just depending. And then thinking about, like, Dr. Justin Lemelor's book, Tell Me What You Want, even thinking about just people, everyday folks who are monogamous relationships are asking for additional people to be invited into their sexual relationship. So that really, you know, just for creativity or to spice up their sex life. So when we think about, like, folks who are actually thinking, like, this is not necessarily such taboo as we thought it was before, and that is actually pretty normal, we can then start to release judgment and release the taboos and hangups that we have around non-monogamous folks and what they do with their sex lives and their relationships. So, yeah, and I think in the umbrella of non-monogamy, there's so many, right? So there's, like, the swingers and the polyamorous, and, you know, there's all sorts of different relationship configurations, yeah, yeah, and constellations, that there really isn't, you know, one way to do these things. But the one thing we do know is hormones. And so the closer we are with someone, the more hormones and dopamine that we get, the more that we are attracting them and they are attracting us. So with that said, so
we're slowly luring them in.
Yeah. Hormones. I mean, we can easily say that you know, yes, you can be monogamous if you are getting out of your relationship what you need. If the dopamine, yeah, hits are good, you can stay monogamous.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if there's other people that are giving you dopamine hits from, I don't know, social media or wherever, you can also feel close to them as well, which can also...
Well, when I talk about monogamy, I've done a few seminars on polyamory,
mm-hmm,
at Oasis Aqua Lounge and at York University here in Toronto. And I always just like to say, even if you're not interested in polyamory, come to us for our ethics, because you can have that totally transferable to monogamy and have better communication with your partner, have them better understand your sexual needs, you understand theirs, and create healthy boundaries around what you want for your body, your pleasure, and understand that from your partner. And consent. I'm like, all these things are so valuable and they're completely transferable to any kind of relationship.
Yeah, exactly. I think sometimes people get confused on like bad behaviors, right? Like if it, people are like, oh, monogamy is toxic. Monogamy is not toxic. You know, what's toxic are the bad behaviors that people do, like possession or being controlling or thinking that you're somebody's property or whatever the case may be. Those are bad behaviors as opposed to, you know, bad relationship dynamics. So I think whatever you feel comfortable with is perfectly fine. It's just more of, are you doing the things that you need to do to have a successful and healthy relationship?
So then let me ask you this. I want to know about your work now. So we went through the bio of everything that you have done. What is it that you do now and what are you focusing on? What are the different avenues that you explore?
Well, right now, like I said, I'm writing the chapter for a book for an intersectional approach to sex therapy. So of course, with Dr. Jess, we wrote The Ultimate Guide to Seduction and Foreplay. So we're still bliss, bathing in the bliss of that book. And I'm also doing a, whom you might know in Toronto, Luna Matatis. We're doing Race and Kink seminar, a bi-weekly discussion series, actually starting next week. And we are really making sure that we have some healthy discussions just around race and kink and what that means. And so we're bringing in lots of amazing guests, such as Dirty Lola and Midori and Ignacio and Aredvi and just a ton, Jet Setting Jasmine King Noir. So just people who have been in the kink industry for a while. And of course, Luna and I are kicking it off and, you know, going to talk about some great stuff. But so there's that. I also, of course, run Sex Down South. So we're moving that virtually for the dates that we had in mind. So September 9th through 12th. And then we are moving the in-person conference to January. Hopefully, you know, with the COVID and everything, things will be hopefully great by then, but that is the plan. So we're going virtual in September. So we're really excited about that opportunity just because it gives us a chance to do something different, have a lot more people have more accessibility to Sex Down South. And it also gives us ideas on how to do something of a hybrid conference and have something for virtual folks who can't make it to the conference, have them also be a part of the conference as well. But we love and touch and hug on each other. So it's, you know, really hard to do that in a, of course, a virtual environment. So those are the things that are coming up, as well as we are planning on having an event in Toronto called Sex on Top. So that is in the works. And that's just more of a day. It's sort of like Sex Down South, but a day long event. So really just depending on the COVID situation.
It
was supposed to be an in-person event. So we are thinking about if it's going to be virtual or not, just because the whole point of Sex Down South is sort of the camaraderie and the touchy-feely and really being able to be close to people. So we are kind of, you know, thinking about what's going to happen with that. But in addition, we have Sex on the Beach here in Miami, Sex on Bourbon in New Orleans, and then Sex in the Middle, which is going to be in Kansas City. So all of those, again, kind of up in the air right now because of COVID. And then I always do my workshops. So I always give live classes. People can join and be a member on my website and have lots of access to, you can have unlimited live classes. You can, there's all sorts of ways for folks to, get involved with my work. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, I wonder if these conferences and expos on sex in the down south, in the areas where you mentioned, like Miami and
Kansas City, New Orleans.
Right. So I'm just wondering how that looks like, because I've only obviously attended the conference here. I've actually attended a sex conference here and the Sex Expo here 2 years running. And what I've noticed here is that the people that typically come to the expos and the sex conferences are predominantly white.
Mm.
So I'm wondering if in the cities that you mentioned, if there's more variety in the humans that tend to attend the sex conferences and what that crowd looks like and who tends to show up.
Yeah, so I think the reason why we created Sex Down South, because I used to always attend, you know, the sex conferences, and they were always predominantly white. And even when we were in those spaces, we were kind of tokenized in those spaces. And so, you know, as a, you know, a queer, Black, cisgender, femme person, like a woman, you know, it was really just sort of daunting to be like, okay, I'm in this industry, yet I don't see people that look like me. And so I really wanted to make sure that for Sex Down South, that we included folks who look like us. So Tia and I, my other co-founder, she's more of a sex enthusiast, right? So she's like the non-monogamous. She's the one that's like venturing out, doing all the things, you know, getting in the trouble. But So I really wanted to draw sort of more academics and, you know, more folks, educators of color, as well as, you know, Black educators, to make sure that we had a space that folks could come to that they didn't have to pay, you know, $500 for, you know. So we really wanted, we're trying to not only make it, you know, accessible to all people, but really financially accessible. And we want other people to see other people like them. So we have a very, very inclusive environment. So you can see people who are Black folks, you can see folks of color, you can see disabled folks, you know, you can see the sex workers, you can see the kinky folks, they're always in their gear. You can see, you know, the non-monogamous, you know, couples and thruples and relationships, you know, that are there. And then you can also see your, you know, the regular people, but, you know, you can also see, you can also see the monogamous couples too, the enthusiasts, the people who just want to learn and are figuring things out for themselves. So we created this conference out of love. And I think that's one of the things that shows up the most, is that we created out of love. So a lot of people approach the situation and approach the conference with love. So nobody's ever like hating on anybody. Everybody just wants to come to an understanding of what's going on. And so we've had very, very, you know, probably less than 3 incidences, which I wouldn't say they were true incidences, you know, in our 6 years, you know, and that just goes to show you that people take the time to talk to each other. People take the time to really understand one another, regardless of all of their identities. And so, yeah, I think it's absolutely fabulous. You got to make sure you come down.
I'd love
when we have it in person. But
it'll be a while. It'll be a while. You mentioned earlier that you are doing a talk together with Luna Mataras and Jess. And you said that you wanted to talk specifically about the intersections of race and kink.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you'd like to talk a little bit more about that, because I also have a sort of question when it comes to something like race play.
Mm-hmm.
Which I've done an episode before with a friend of mine. He's a Black man in the sex positive communities. And he mentioned that he was sort of caught up in a situation where he was a bull with a white couple and they engaged him non-consensually in race play. So we had a sort of long discussion about it on one of the episodes. And I've not had the opportunity to ask anybody else about race play particularly. So our kind of position at the end of that episode was it's not something that he's comfortable with. And I was of the mind that I don't know if this could be done safely consensually because the power dynamic still exists versus other power dynamics that are not as evident.
Yeah. So what's really great with Luna came up with, you know, we have like this sex positive, like sort of race and kink resource list that we'll be giving to people, which I think people can sort of, we're there to sort of instigate some conversation around this, right? And so with race play, I mean, it's one of those things that like, is it healing to you? Are you comfortable with it? Or, you know, if someone is engaging with you, not consensually, why did they, how? Like, I'm just like, oh my gosh. Like, first of all, my head was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe someone did that.
Yeah.
And thinking about like, how do you not be conscious of those things? But, you know, it's sort of like when white people say, you know, I don't see race, you know, it's like, yeah, you do, actually.
Yeah, no, you're colorblind.
Yeah. It's like, no, that doesn't exist. And so I think race play is very, it all depends on who it is. And actually, we're going to be talking about that with Dirty Lola more so, because I know Dirty Lola is a biracial Black femme who has a white daddy. And so so thinking about like those dynamics, right? Even those power dynamics sort of in real life, you know, versus in play, and, you know, how those play out. So we'll definitely have some conversations about that, and hoping to get some more people who engage in race play, actually you're like, no, I like being in this position. We would love to hear more from those folks. Mm. But like I said, sometimes it's healing for folks. Sometimes, you know, I think it's very individualized. I know it's interesting because like at Sex Down South, there were people who, you know, so there would be some kink folks there, some white, you know, white guys, like older white guys, and they had, you know, their badge names. It would be like Master such and such, right? And walking into the space of like Black and brown people, and, you know, I would have some Black folks come up to me and be like, I am not calling him Master such and such, whatever, you know, like, and I'd be like, that is totally fine, just talk to him, you know, just say like, hey, I don't feel comfortable calling you this, like, I recognize that maybe it's a part of your kink dynamic, but I would rather call you this. I said, that's why we created this, so you could have those conversations and not feel like, hopefully some people are feeling some type of way about it. And so we did have one of the guys actually kind of cross out, you know, the master, and just like, you can just call me this, like, you can just call me by my name. You don't have to, like, you know, you don't have to, that was just the badge name and what I wanted. But now that I'm here and I know this space, like, I would feel comfortable with you just calling me by my name. Right. You know, because being a white man in this space, you know, he was definitely one of the minority in that space. So,
it sounds really good that you put this conference together, because one of the things that my friend Luther mentioned in that interview was that if there were more Black folks in the sex positive communities here, then it wouldn't be as easy for him and people like him who don't want to be engaged in race play, especially non-consensually, to be tokenized in that way, because then people would have exposure to more varieties of different kinks, different needs from people from the Black community and other people of color, right? Because if there's only, let's say, 5 Black men in a given space and they're all treated as bulls, then that tends to get repeated over time, or at least people might assume that that's the only role that's available to them. And I mean this for...
That's right.
Yeah, in Luther's mind, he's like, I don't want to be just this role, but he's like, I feel like this is the only role available to me. He's like, if there were more people like me in the sex positive communities, then maybe, you know, I could explore things like my sexuality, which may not just be, you know...
Yeah, there's some really good spaces like Nadia Nolens, who have a really great outlook on their community members and establishing sort of guidelines in those communities. But they, you know, like they weren't exempt either, right? So I know at one point they had like the chocolate room, right? Which was all black men, you know, single black men, you know, ready to have sex with whomever, right? And so thinking about things like that, who now, of course, they changed it, right? They changed the name of the room. They're not calling it the chocolate room anymore. Great. But the dynamic is still there, right? Mm-hmm. So they're calling it the plus one room, right? Mm-hmm. Or whatever. And so that feels, you know, better. But at the same time, you know, if you are a black man coming into this community, you're coming into a swingers community such as that one, then you might see, okay, I either have to be in a couple or I got to be in the plus one room or whatever. And so navigating those dynamics, I know probably would be very, very difficult. And like you said, can hinder or inhibit someone to not be able to explore their sexuality.
Yeah. Well, then the next thing I wanted to talk to you about or to ask you is what it's like discussing topics like sex and gender in academic settings, because it mentions in your bio that you do lecture, and how that differs from other public settings, and if you have a preference.
Well, mind you, you know, at the university, I'm teaching, I teach a wide range of folks, but for the most part, these are, you know, kids coming out of high school, right? So these are like 18, 19, 20-year-olds, and their concept of gender and sexuality, unfortunately, is very limited, and it just really goes to show, like, why are we not teaching this earlier, right? Why are we not teaching women's and gender studies in junior high or, you know, in middle school? Like, why are we not teaching them? Because they come into my class and I'm just like, wait, what? Like, you know, just not having enough information. And so actually it really rewards me in a sense of that I'm able to give them these texts and give them these responses and help them to think about their own gender and sexuality in ways that they have never even thought of. So for instance, I had some students who we talked about, there's an article about intersex people and, you know, what would you do? And I think one of my discussion questions is like, what if your baby was intersex? How would you raise the child? And, you know, some people are like, I've never even heard of this word before, let alone now I got to think about my kids. And like, yes, I want you to think about all of those things, right? And I think helping them to expand their minds will help them visualize what they can be as people, right? They don't have to be in these boxes that, you know, we've labeled and put them in, you know, or that their family has put them in or their religion has put them in, or these social institutions, whatever they may be, have put them in. And so I'm really thankful that I get that opportunity to educate our young people and some of our old people, you know, who are taking those classes for the first time. And I also think it's really rewarding to educate adults. You know, when I have private clients or coaching clients, I really, I get excited that like, hey, I get to introduce them to this new thing. And they have a developed brain enough to where they're like, oh my gosh, like now I can think about my world in this sort of different way. But honestly, I feel like if we had that information sooner in life, we would be better off, you know? And I think because of SESTA FOSTA, we are limited, especially as sex educators, in our abilities to reach out to people. Like I can't advertise. I can't, you know, do these things that other people in different industries can do because people think it might be too sexually explicit, which is just, I just think it's so ironic how they're like, we can't expose children to sex and what sex means and does. And like, do they know that they came from sex? How some of our children have come from sex, you know, like what makes you think that they can't handle this information? But I think that mostly goes to a variety of influences, around sex and the taboo and, you know, all the different institutions, like I said, that want us to think sex is a bad thing.
So there's two really interesting things that you said there. First, I want to say I didn't know that Sesta Fosta affected sex educators from advertising. For the listeners who don't know, Sesta Fosta are the laws that were put in place in the United States meant to protect sex workers, but actually it ends up doing a lot more harm to sex workers by not allowing them to do things like advertise online where they would normally get their clients and be able to conduct their business, and instead might push them onto the streets or onto areas where they don't have the same sorts of safety. But I didn't know that that applied to advertising sex education programs. Or is that what you meant?
Yeah, no. So it applies, to advertising. So we can't like Instagram, Facebook, Google, you know, we can't put anything on there because they'll automatically take it off. So you have to be real creative in your language, you know, all of these things that, but I know for a fact that I think my company has already been flagged for being sexually explicit. So even if I try to advertise something, I think it still gets denied. It could be how to kiss, and kissing is what would get denied, you know? Well,
you know, you haven't made it as a sex educator until you get shadow banned.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And the other thing you mentioned was the importance of education when it comes to, you know, sex ed. And I think this trails out even outside of sex education. I taught a course on biology and the brain. It was a psychology course. But looking at the textbook, which is supposed to be modern, because as you know, universities like to publish the same thing every year and modify about 25% of the books so that they can charge students $150 for a textbook. But these textbooks perpetuate, I think, sometimes irresponsible science. Namely, when science is diluted and sort of translated to the public, it tends to be simplified. And in the process of simplifying some of that, you have problematic understandings. Such things like biological sex has been propagated as a binary for so long that it just seems like biological sex has all to do with chromosomes. And if you look at the actual science behind it, you know that it's not just chromosomes, right? It's hormones as well. It's a particular aspect of chromosomes, not the whole thing. And then there's varieties. There's not just X, Y, and there's X, Y, Y, and X, X, Y, and a whole slew of things. And this doesn't leave room for things like intersex people to even exist. And then it challenges notions of what gender means, even though they're not necessarily related. And it problematizes all these sorts of ideas about the possibility of the existence of people outside of cis men and cis women. And I had to, even in teaching that course, I had to take a part of that lecture and just go into the politics of it, because I'm like, I can't teach this text and assume that it's doing a responsible job when it treats sex as a binary category, because that's just not true. And even if science likes to take this lens, like, oh, well, the exceptions are just few. It's not good enough. It's not good enough because we're not few anymore.
You know, there's
a lot more visibility now that people have been given a little bit of leeway to come out and explore gender, sexuality, and so on. I'd like to insert a reference here on a study done on the diversity of biological sex. This is by Amanda Montañez in the journal Scientific American, and the title of the article is called Beyond XX and XY. Now, in this paper, the study outlines the diversity of biological sex, and it looks at least five factors that contribute to biological sex. The first is chromosomes, of which there are several varieties, such as XX, X, XXY, and XY, among other possibilities. There are genes, and this is one of the primary determinants of biological sex, which is the presence or absence of the SRY gene. But then there are also instances where this gene is either mutated or complicated through mutation with other genes, which actually has a spectrum of the types of intersex people that exist between typically male and typically female that are determined by the presence or absence of the SRY gene. And you could see a graph in this study that shows the range of the types of intersex people that are possible actually outnumbers the two categories of biological sex. There are several types of intersex possibilities that can exist between the strict categories of male and female. Then you have hormones that also complicate this because they interact with the gene and the chromosomes. And then you have internal and external organs, and this is observed at birth. And again, there are varieties between just male and female internal and external genital structures on a spectrum of intersex possibilities. And then you have secondary sex characteristics such as breasts or facial hair. And again, these can also vary depending on the interaction of hormones, genes, chromosomes, and the internal and external sex organs. So what this study particularly says, and I quote, "Humans are socially conditioned to view sex and gender as binary attributes. From the moment we are born, or even before, we are definitively labeled boy or girl. Yet science points to a much more ambiguous reality. Determination of biological sex is staggeringly complex, involving not only anatomy, but an intricate choreography of genetic and chemical factors that unfold over time. Intersex individuals, those for whom sexual development follows an atypical trajectory, are characterized by a diverse range of conditions, such as 5-alpha reductase deficiency. A small cross-section of these conditions and the pathways they follow is shown here. In an additional layer of complexity, the gender with which a person identifies does not always align with the sex they are assigned at birth, and they may not be wholly male or female. The more we learn about sex and gender, the more these attributes appear to exist on a spectrum." So aside from outlining the various possibilities of biological sex and the complex interactions between chromosomes, genes, hormones, internal and external organs, and secondary sex characteristics, they also stipulate that biological sex does not have a determining relationship to gender. What that means is that independent of what you are assigned at birth or what your biology may indicate, it does not necessarily indicate your gender. I will link this article in the description of this episode, and you can find that on any podcast app. From the article, you can access the graph, which is a visual representation of the diversity in biological sex. So I think that's a very important point that you make. We don't offer children sex education early enough. And then even the science that we teach them is oversimplified in a way that actually limits the possibilities for that sex education to flourish and their sexual experiences to flourish.
Yeah, it's so interesting too. Since you mentioned it, I'm actually working on another project too, because I realize parents don't want to talk to their kids about sex. So I'm like, you know, I will be that parent. I will be the person that can talk to your kids about sex, you know? And so there's a platform that I'm actually looking to build off of and just say like, hey, sign your kids up for this class and I will teach them about age appropriate, you know, sex ed. And I think we need more of that, because, you know, parents, they're shy. But then they, you know, catch their kid watching porn and then they're like, oh, I don't know what to do now. Or, you know, what does that even mean? So, or just, you know, maybe they might be bullying someone and they don't even know the context of anything. You know, it's just, there's just so many nuances when it comes to sex and sexuality that a lot of parents don't know. A lot of adults don't know. So
naturally,
hey, if I could do my job and get them early, that'd be great.
I think it's also helpful for, you know, young people growing up to maybe not just have their parents who might not be equipped to teach them these things, but they might also want to look to somebody who's not a parent to talk about sex, because there might be a source of discomfort there.
Yeah.
So that's good that you're taking on that work. I hope that is rewarding for you.
You're like, Ed, that's a lot.
It sounds like you're doing a lot, which makes me want to ask, I have actually two questions about your work with regards to how much you're taking on and the current climate. The first one being how COVID has impacted your work.
Yeah, so with COVID, actually, so I thought it was very interesting because I was on a panel on Saturday, or maybe the last Saturday, a couple weeks ago, and there was we talked about how COVID has sort of affected sex educators, and it's really interesting because my business has gone up tremendously, and I believe that SX Noir, who she was saying that the people who already had video or webcam things already in place are the folks who are doing well in this. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. Cause I've been doing video calls since forever. And so, which why my reach has been so expansive. And so for me, it's gone up. Business has gone up, and also people are sheltering in place with their partners who normally they would just go to work and then come back and only spend like so much time with them. And now they're spending 24/7 with them. And now they're like, oh my gosh, who is this person? Right. So, so I'm getting a lot of like, we need to work on something because something's off here. So, I've been seeing that and just people actually genuinely wanting to improve their sex life and now having the time to focus in and really do it. And so I'm really actually super proud of those couples who are doing the work and taking the time to get there. And so for me, business has been great. It has not slowed me down. It's only sort of made me more innovative in my strategies and what I want to do and what I want to accomplish. So I feel very good about my work in this space, in this virtual space. And I'm looking forward to what we probably should have been doing all along, in a sense. You know, I think there's very much value with being in person. I'm an extrovert. I love how, and I'm a touchy-feely person, right? So I'm like, I love touchy-feeling, you know, poking people, whatever. But like, but also for folks who need accessibility, I think this is a great, I'm glad sort of COVID has sort of stopped people in their tracks to say, hey, look at the things, look at the different ways that we can communicate. So I found it to be an opportunity.
And I think it's good too, because for me, I always did my interviews in person with this podcast. So now I've been forced to go online and do them like this, which previously I rejected the idea just because I thought, well, there's a lack of intimacy and connection that, you know, in person, you get a little bit more of that. But because of COVID, not only has it forced me to do this, but it's also forced audiences to accept listening to something that may not be as sharp, as clean, as like studio quality audio, because you're there for the content now.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So you're willing to excuse some of that. And we're seeing that a lot. I was just watching The Daily Show and Trevor Noah's in his house and the editing isn't there in the same way, but I'm like, you're there for the content.
Right.
And this is the reason I was supposed to interview both Jessica O'Reilly and Luna Matadas, but both of them couldn't schedule with me in person and both requested to do online stuff. And I'm like, I wasn't equipped at the time to do it. So now I'm going to have to reach out to them again and be please, second chance, because I've wanted to talk to them for quite a while now. So I think that's one nice thing that we've gotten out of COVID, along with maybe slowing down a little bit and allowing ourselves to use this time to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And among those things could be things like intimacy with partners.
Yeah. You know, you were speaking to something earlier, actually, that sort of flashed back to me was thinking about like the Black and Brown folks in Toronto in your area. When we decided to do, or when we wanted to do Sex on Top, you know, there were people that we collaborated with, like the Black Daddies Club, if you're familiar with them. And then there's some other, oh gosh, there's a little city next to Toronto. What is it called?
Scarborough, Etobicoke, Vaughan, Mississauga.
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 Yeah, I think so. It's like a little crevice. I can't remember. Anyway, I'm like thinking on the map of where
it is. Looking at it.
But there were a lot of black and brown folks that are doing like independent things. And so I think there's like, we were trying to do something all together. And so I think with, you know, hopefully, you know, when we come out of COVID, we'll be able to, especially in Toronto and the area, just so people can have that sort of space to see that there are black and brown people doing this work in this area. And that it's not, you know, because of course you go to Oasis, you barely see, you know, black and brown people. And yet, I mean, they're doing great stuff and great work. And, you know, I love presenting there when I was there. And, but I would definitely really love to see like more folks of color, you know, come out to those establishments. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The second question that I was going to ask, so COVID has impacted your work relatively positively. Mm-hmm. I wonder how the Black Lives Matter resurgence has impacted your work. And if this changes anything for sex education, for sex positivity, where race is now far more visible than it has been before. So I wonder how that's been for you with regards to your work.
Yeah, so I think it's fascinating when people say this because this has been my whole life, right? Like, I don't think there's never been a time that I haven't been thinking about Black people and what Black people have been doing. So like I said, when we created Sex Down South, it was because there were no Black conferences. There wasn't anything like it. And even with this movement, I think what we're starting to see now is that other white, like white people are starting to wake up, right? They stopped hitting the snooze button because, you know, they saw George Floyd's murder and they're like, oh my God, wow, it's really happening. But we as Black people know this has been happening for a long time. We have a long history of this happening. And so for me, I've always been doing this work and I'm continuing to do this work. And so this has not stopped me or changed me in any way. I think it's just more this movement. I'm happy that more people are waking up. But it hasn't changed the work that I've been doing because I've always been doing this work. So for me, I just feel grateful and thankful that there are people now that are starting to be like, hey, we need to change things. You know, how can we change things or what are the things that we need to do? I think that's great. I think that's awesome. As far as my work, I've been doing this work, so nothing will change. Like for me, I will always be promoting, you know, Black folks. I will always be promoting, you know, other, you know, uplifting, you know, marginalized voices like I've been doing. So for me, it hasn't changed, but.
You're the second person that said something similar to me because I've asked somebody this, not off the air, but I've just asked, you know, how the BLM movement has been affecting them. And I got the same response, like, this has been my life. This has been my experience. He's like, this is nothing new. You know? Like, I'm hopeful that more things will change as a result. And I'm glad to see more allies showing up. But yeah, and I think that's part of the, ironically, that's part of the awakening is also realizing that Black folks have been in this struggle for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually just been invisible to white folks because of privilege. And I think it also intersects a little bit with COVID. Now that we've had this period of slowing down, we've been able to pay attention.
Oh, yes.
And show up and go to the rallies and educate ourselves and read the books and turn to Black educators to see what we've been missing out on in history and in current events. Because, even, you know, me going to school here, I remember Black History Month being a thing that was in the corridors, not even in the classroom.
Mm.
You know, I went to 4 different high schools.
Wow.
One in each year. And in grade school, I moved around about 10 or 11 times. So I've been through so many different schools all over Ontario. And I do not remember getting a significant or even a memorable education on Black history or anything to do with Black culture. I remember seeing posters in the hallways about Black History Month. That's it.
Right, yeah.
And not in the classroom.
Right.
So this is something, again, about our education system. And mm-hmm. and I am hopeful that you know, this time around, the activist work will hopefully create some of the changes that have been asked for decades.
Right.
And maybe centuries.
Yeah, I'm hoping that there's some real change that happens, you know. I'm hoping, but yeah, I will always continue.
You're
to
like,
do this work,
yeah, sure. you've been doing it. You're like, yeah. I hear you. You've been doing the work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to say that now it's our turn to do the work, white folks, to start showing up and do some of the hard lifting, because I've seen a lot of white folks drop off the map because now they're exhausted from seeing the activism and being asked to do the work. And I'm like, check your privilege a little bit, because, like, you know, you were just getting started. You were just getting started on some of this work.
Yeah, it's so funny. I was on a podcast like the other day, and there was we talked about, I was just like, I just want to see, they're like, what do you hope for white folks? And I'm like, I want more resilience from white folks. Like, yeah. I want them to, like, you know, yes, you're tired. I'm tired. I've been tired. But guess what? I wake up and I still do this work every day. You know, like, there's no room. There's no room for that. There's no room if we want to make some sort of change. And so you just got to take care of yourself, and you just got to be resilient, and then, you know, come out.
Well, this
out fighting.
I think what you said there makes a strong point, even in the negative sense, which is, why aren't we resilient? Why aren't we strong and confident? And my answer to that is because of a false meritocracy, where you've been given a privilege to assume strength, confidence, and resiliency, but it's never been tested. And now that you're getting tested, you're like, oh, well, I didn't, you know, I thought I could, but now I can't. And the people who've been tested have a genuine strength and resilience that...
Yes, that's so good, Patrick. Yes, I like that.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I've been actually trying to write a piece about this. I've been, I wrote a proto paper about it, about what, it kind of picks up a little bit on white fragility, but more specifically on this, like, wavering confidence and this need for emotional labor from Black folks to deal with white fragility and to deal with, oh, I feel like I'm stepping on eggshells and I don't know what to say and I don't know what to do and all this confusion and lack of confidence. I was like, well, the reason you have that is because you're not used to being silenced. You're not used to being tested. Mm-hmm. And whenever you had confidence in the past, it was from a place of privilege because you've never had to question your place in things, your place in the narrative. And when the narrative is, you know, decenters you, what do you do? Well, you got to learn.
Yeah, exactly. You got to learn. You got to be resilient. Yes. I love it. I can't wait to see this piece.
Well, I got to write a proper one. I wrote a 3-pager and I passed it on to someone to look over, and I've had some feedback. So now I do a nice rewrite.
Okay. Well, please keep me informed. I would love to share it with my network.
All right. Well, this brings me to my last formal question. Which is, what do you hope for the future in terms of intersectionality in sex positivity?
So my hope for the future is that we are able to expand our brains, our language, to expand our networks, to be inclusive of other people and see and what that looks like. And so, for instance, if you're always used to being around certain people, what, like, to really psychoanalyze yourself, is that, you know, are you okay? What if you are in a different environment from someone who's different from you? Or if you're, as an entrepreneur, business-minded person, I'm always thinking about business. So it's just like, who are the people that I am attracting? Why am I attracting those people? And what are the things that I'm putting into place that are letting people know that, hey, they belong here. They belong with me. They belong, you know, talking with me. And so I really just want people to be more inclusive in how they talk, how they teach, and how they live their life. So that is my hope. And of course, when people need to have exclusive spaces, of course, you're going to have those exclusive spaces. And I think, you know, whatever identities that we hold, I think for me, they're precious. Like, I know some people are like, oh, I don't want to be labeled or this or that. But I think if we hold on to so many different identities, I think it helps us with our values of how we can be different because of all of these identities and how we can be interdisciplinary in the ways that we teach and in the ways that we learn. So that is my hope for a more interdisciplinary world, a more intersectional world, and a more inclusive world. And I think that is my ultimate hope, and that people will embrace love a lot better when we can think about other people. So yeah,
wonderful.
That's my hope for the world.
Well, before I let you go, there is one other thing that I ask my guests traditionally at the end of an episode to end off on a sort of light note. And again, you can choose to opt out of this, but I usually ask for what I've called a sexy story, which could be a sexy tale. It could be a wild story, fun, outrageous, whatever, if you have something that you'd like to share.
Oh gosh, I have so many stories.
I've never had anybody say, I don't have a story. Let's put it that way. The people I interview typically will have too many damn stories.
I know, I'm like, one story? Oh gosh. Okay, a short story. I'm trying to think. Short story. Okay. So a short story, I would say. So last year, I was in the dungeon at Sex Down South, and I was having a really great time. And I was hoping that people would, I'm really sort of getting into kinky stuff, whatchamacallit, pussy torture. And so,
nice.
So I was, you know, getting into that scene, and then just a lot, and I was just really feeling the energy, and it was really amazing. And then there was a woman who was like, this white woman in particular, she wanted to be topped for her birthday. And so I was just like, yeah, so come on over here. So, you know, I did some spanking, had some people spank her. I had, you know, I was doing some punching, and then I started to do some slapping on her. And I asked her if she wanted to go harder, and she said yes. And I slapped her, and I ended up slapping the nose ring out of her nose. And it started bleeding. And I was like, holy shit. I was like, I knew I was heavy-handed, but, you know, wow. So, of course, you know, we had to tend to her right away. But she was fine. She was, you know, on all the adrenaline and all the good, happy hormones and all the dopamine and everything else. So she was good. But
she had the nose ring slapped out of her.
Yeah, she had the nose ring slapped out of her face. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That's a nice short story for you.
Well, thank you so much. And then before I actually let you go, this is your chance to plug away all the places where people can find you, shamelessly plug all your things. And I'm going to put them also in the description of that. This
episode. It is description. No.
Scripture.
So of course, Jess and I's book, The Ultimate Guide to Seduction and Foreplay, just came out. That is Techniques and Strategies for Mind-Blowing Sex. You can find that on my website, velvetlipssexed.com. And you can find me on social media, Velvet Lips Sex Ed. That's sex without the E. And then, of course, if you want to get personal or want to know more of what I do, my handles are the number one, Marla Stewart. And that is for Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. All of those handles are the same in that. And then if you want some sex advice, you can go to my YouTube channel, Velvet Lips Sex Ed. And you can, you know, if you want to watch me and see me in action, you can do that. As well as go on Eventbrite, you can find the Race and Kink bi-weekly discussion series. And, of course, sexdownsouth.com for the sex conference, sex and sexuality conference in Atlanta, but that will be virtually. So, yeah, those are all the things I can think of for now.
Just a few. Well, amazing. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I had a really good time. You're listening to Intellectual Erection, a place where we talk about the naughty to stimulate your thinking.